Politics divide a California family today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Marco Gutierrez plans to vote for Trump in the California primary. He thinks Trump's right on deporting undocumented immigrants.
We just have to legalize ourselves. The process of legalization is going to be hard work, and they need to do it.
I think that's complete bull.
Gutierrez's daughter sees it differently.
People have been here very long. They've already made a life here. You really want to send them back?
Plus, immigrant students in Texas learn more than just English.
I've had a Vietnamese student think that a Salvadorian girl is very beautiful and want to talk to her, so he goes and tries to speak to her in Spanish to see if she'll give him her name.
Those stories and more coming up today on The World. Glad you could make it here today. We're actually going to start off looking at tomorrow. It's a big day in the countdown to November elections. Voters are going to cast ballots in primary races in states including New Jersey, North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, and New Mexico. But most of the attention will be focused on the biggest prize, the Golden State, California. That's where Donald Trump spent last week on the stump. The World's Monica Campbell followed him to San Jose, a city that is heavily immigrant, Latino, and Democrat. Not Trump's sweet spot, to be sure, Monica. So what was the mood as you approached the gathering?
In the line for people to go and see Donald Trump inside, it wasn't all white. I mean, there were a number of Latinos, Asians, South Asians. I met one father and daughter there. The father, his name is Marco Gutierrez, Mexican-American in his 40s, pro-Trump. And he was there with his daughter, Amelia. She's 14 years old, born in the United States. She was pro-Sanders, and she went with her dad to this rally kind of out of curiosity. They strongly disagree on Trump's proposal to deport millions of immigrants here who live here without authorization. You know, her dad thinks these people should go back and come back in legally. And here's what they said.
We just have to legalize ourselves. The process of legalization is going to be hard work, and they need to do it.
I think that's complete bull. People have been here very long. They've already made a life here. You really want to send them back?
They are already being deported. Obama has been deporting all these people. Just he hasn't said it on TV like Donald Trump is saying.
If you want to think about it like that, the whites are illegal. Mexico was here first. They moved to California first. What is up with that? And there's so much racial prejudice against everybody. And Donald Trump, I don't see him helping at all with that.
How has it been for you guys as a family to have these discussions?
I actually think it's brought my dad and I closer, like our relationship, because we used to not really talk to each other, but now we are.
It's divisive, very divisive.
All right. So Amelia there, 14 years old and can't vote, but fascinating to hear her talking it out with her pro-Trump dad.
What I thought was interesting about this particular father and daughter was that, you know, the dad, he came to California in the early 80s. He got amnesty through Ronald Reagan, but he also had to go back to Mexico and wait and come back into California. He obviously has a lot of respect for that process, and he thinks other people should do it too. And now he runs a business and is competing with a lot of people who are here without papers, who are taking, he says, jobs away from people that want to do those jobs and have papers. So he's facing that competition that we see that's real between people without papers and those who can get hired legally.
Right.
His daughter just does not see it that way.
What about other people you met at that Trump rally in San Jose, like the still undecideds or protesters? Did you speak with them?
I met three young Mexican-American teenagers there for the first time to protest in their lives regarding any political action. They were driven to come downtown to San Jose by what Trump says about Latinos. And here's what one of those young women said. Her name's Lily Guerrero.
My parents, they haven't voted previously because I just think that they didn't think it affects them. But I think now I'm going to convince them to vote. There's that stereotype that Hispanic people are lazy. Every job that I've seen a Latino person do has been hard work. Like, my mom works at a restaurant 7 days a week, and I just don't see how anyone could ever say that that's lazy or she's not working hard for the things she has.
Yeah, and it was not very encouraging either, Monica, what happened to them on their way over to the rally. What happened?
you know, San Jose is got to be one of the most diverse cities in the country. And they said that when they were walking over to the rally, a few people wearing Trump T-shirts called them gang members because they had these bandanas in their hair, which is normal here. And they found that really shocking. And here's what one of the young women said. Her name's Natalie Hernandez.
I think it's because we're brown and we were like Hispanic. But if we were like...
They're being racist about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If we were like white and we were wearing bandanas, it would be for like some other reason, for like fashion.
Yeah, that is that's got to be kind of shocking when you encounter that in a place like San Jose. So, Monica, at the Trump rally, you did not stick around for the speech by Donald Trump himself. And that decision tells us something about the state of America today. Tell us why you decided to leave.
Well, I decided to leave because I'm in my third trimester of pregnancy, and I decided that it wasn't going to be safe for me to be at this political rally, which I find kind of crazy because it should be a safe place. I find it just amazing that I'm having to think about my own personal safety here in California, in my hometown of San Jose, when it comes to covering a political event and thinking, you know, am I going to have to worry about getting thrown to the ground, pushed around, and that sort of thing? And it says a lot about the political climate right now in the United States. And I just wonder how it's going to get over the next few months.
The World's Monica Campbell in San Jose. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
One California resident who won't be voting tomorrow is named Desiree. She'd rather not use her last name. Desiree is a doctor. She grew up in Singapore but moved to the UK to study. From there, she came to the US. Desiree is a permanent resident, so it wouldn't be difficult for her to become a citizen and vote. But she's decided not to do that. She is following the election, however, as she tells our producer Daniel Gross, who also happens to be her son.
I think I follow it involuntarily, if you get what I mean. How can one avoid it? It's a bit of a circus. It's like entertainment, like a reality show, except it's not a show. It's the real thing. But I probably don't spend a lot of time talking about it. It's something that you carefully avoid if you want to keep your friends.
So what will you be doing when the rest of California is voting?
I'll be watching with amusement.
And why won't you be voting?
I'll tell you why. When I first came to the United States, I was shocked in the cereal aisle. I know it sounds trivial to have over 20 brands of cereal. I grew up with two choices, cornflakes and Rice Krispies, and both were treats. So here I am in the biggest democracy in the world, and there are two parties to choose from, essentially. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Neither party represents all my views, so I can think of better things to make a difference to people's lives. You know how they say, at the end of your life, the things you regret are the things you didn't do. So would I regret not voting? I don't think so.
So have you ever voted in your life?
No, I left my birth country too young to be able to vote. I grew up in a system that was essentially one party. So voting wasn't a big deal because you knew who was going to win. It was a benign system. And then I have been a traveling global citizen ever since. I've lived on three continents. So I more or less foregone my opportunity to vote in any country that I've lived in.
A lot of immigrants value voting more than a lot of Americans do. Some immigrants see it as the final step toward becoming an American. Why do you think it hasn't played out that way for you?
You're right. It is symbolic of belonging. It hasn't played out for me because I have not felt that I've escaped any circumstance to come to this country. I came here by marriage to your father. I mean, the point of voting is to make a difference, but I feel like I make a much bigger difference by what I do every single day. How can I help my neighbor, my friend? What can I teach that will help my students be better healthcare providers? You choose to volunteer, you choose to make a difference in the way you can.
Is there anything that a politician could do? Let's say, is there anything that Hillary Clinton could do or Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump could do to convince you to vote?
Now, what would persuade me if several parties appear, new parties, and I could identify with the views of one of them? But then all this, I guess what I call corruption, all this to do with money and campaigns and strategies, is so much about strategy. That's a real turnoff. As the current election shows, the office of the president of America can be bought. If you come from poverty, that position is out of your range. I think I could make more difference by donating my money to the causes that matter to me than I could by voting. I know it sounds very stubborn, almost escapist, but voting does not wake me up in the morning. The chance to vote is not something that I wake up and look forward to.
California resident Desiree explaining why she's chosen not to become a citizen and vote in a conversation with her son, producer Daniel Gross. A couple of weeks ago, we told you about a bold move that voters in Switzerland were considering, a guaranteed basic income for everyone, $2,500 a month, tax-free, for every adult Swiss citizen. Well, yesterday, a referendum was held on the proposal, and over 75% of Swiss voters rejected it. But why? It sounded so good. I asked my BBC colleague Imogen Fuchs in Switzerland to explain.
As you said, it sounds quite radical, $2,500 a month for every legal adult resident, whether he or she works or not. Let's not forget, this was the first ever nationwide vote on introducing such a thing anywhere in the world. So, you know, change in many places takes a while to happen. And I don't think, you know, this was the first shot at it. I think, though, perhaps what we should be aware of is that basic income is not an entirely new idea. You know, the late American economist Milton Friedman, who's on the right, he quite liked the idea because he said it would eliminate what he called a rag bag of welfare payments. Mm. But as you said, it's quite a lot for the voters to digest and vote yes to, particularly with this proposal. Had a lot of ideals, but not a whole lot of detail about how exactly it would be it would be paid for and implemented.
We reported actually on some of the positive effects of a guaranteed basic income where it had been tested, like in Namibia and Manitoba in Canada. Dropout rates fall, school enrollment goes up, women have longer maternity leaves, and so on. Does this mean that the idea is completely dead in Switzerland?
I don't think so. I don't think so at all, because I think the campaigners in favor said that they hoped if they got more than 22% of the vote, they would be happy because it was the first ever vote on such a thing. There was a very lively debate across Switzerland about the pros and cons. That's the interesting thing about this system of direct democracy. You have these votes. It forces people to talk about new issues, new possible political legislation. So I think the supporters are quite happy with their kind of 23% of the vote.
Imogen, I'm curious, how much do you think the current migrant and refugee crisis in Europe played into this vote?
Certainly the right-wing political parties in Switzerland said, look, if we're going to be the one country, a small country, only 8 million people, to introduce this, it will be like a kind of golden ticket for economic migrants. People will say, particularly in the European Union, because Switzerland has free movement for the European Union, they will say, that's the place to go. That is where we can either get a job, or if we don't, we can have $2,500 a month. Mm. In fact, if you read the fine print, you wouldn't have got this money unless you were a permanent resident for a minimum of 5 years here. So you would have had to contribute something beforehand. But I think the fear of uncontrolled migration, which is something many Western European countries are discussing at the moment, including Switzerland, will have played a role. But I think the bigger role was very radical plan, long on ideals and short on detail.
My colleague with the BBC, Imogen Fuchs, is speaking with me from Bern, the capital of Switzerland. Thanks very much, Imogen.
Thank you.
Semi-precious stones fueling the war in Afghanistan. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. You've probably heard the terrible news. NPR photojournalist David Gilkey and his translator, Zabiola Tamana, were killed yesterday in Afghanistan. Their deaths are a reminder that the Afghan war is far from over, despite the withdrawal of most U.S. troops. It also reminds us about the men and women who work as translators and fixers, helping foreign reporters get the story. Matthew Akins is usually based in Kabul, but today we reached him in Athens. He knew both journalists who died yesterday.
Well, it's really a tough blow. I mean, it's kind of a tight-knit community of people who've worked in Kabul, and everyone looks out for each other as best they can. And so when you lose someone, it's really tragic. And both David and Zabiola were, you know, well-known journalists, really well-respected. A lot of people had, you know, kind of early experiences when they came to Kabul, because they were two guys who'd been around for a while, and that was the case for me. And it's a sad mood, definitely.
I don't know if you worked with Zabiola as a fixer, but presumably you have worked with fixers before in Afghanistan.
Of course, you know, you're relying on fixers when you go to a country that's foreign to you. So very often, while you may be in it for your career or to make money back home eventually, you know, in a solid job, they're basically there and often supporting a family. So the risks that you take together are not always rewarded in the same way. And that's why it hurts especially to see someone lose their life like this.
So tell me more about the kind of experiences you've had with your fixers and the kind of risks that you both share.
Well, you share the same risks. I mean, when you go out on an embed like this and you're driving in armored vehicles and a rocket gets fired at the vehicle you're in, and you know it doesn't discriminate, it kills you both. That's what happened to David and Zabiola. But in another sense, actually, I think fixers risk a lot more. I mean, you can leave at the end of your assignment, but they're stuck there. If you pissed off some warlord or militant group, often it can come back on them. And they also have far less protection, you know, from the Afghan government or being arrested, being detained. They've been detained in the past by the U.S. military as well. So they're often taking more risks than you are.
Since the U.S. troops left Afghanistan, we've seen coverage of Afghanistan drop. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, there's no question about that. It was in 2010, it was the top foreign news story. And as the troops have left, that interest has gone. Though it's still, you know, in fairness, one of the top foreign stories worldwide.
How much do you think safety for journalists changed after the U.S. troops left?
Well, this is a good example, isn't it? I mean, the fact is they were killed on an embed with the Afghan National Army. And I've embedded both the U.S. military and the ANA, and there's very, very different levels of safety involved. You know, most notably with the U.S., not only is the level of competence and professionalism and technology much higher, but you're always within close reach of a medevac, right? If you get hit, its chopper can get you to this world-class hospital. And, well, they try for the golden hour, right, within an hour, and often much quicker than that. With the Afghan army, it's very different. You know, often you're looking at a road evacuation that could take hours, if not, you know, a day or two.
With what happened so tragically to David Gilkey and Zabiola Tamana, does it make you reassess your own safety? Like, every time something like this happens, do you kind of go through a personal reassessment?
Of course you do. Of course this forces you to reflect on what you're doing. But at the same time, this is a war. These are conflicts. You know, that's what we're doing out there. We're going to cover situations that are extremely dangerous where people are dying. And the reason we're doing that is because people are dying. And though they're not foreign journalists, they're dying every day and their lives are, you know, just as meaningful. And then that's what drives you to go and try to report about these conflicts.
Matthew, where do you think our understanding of Afghanistan would be, of really any war zone, without fixers?
The fixer is absolutely essential for foreign journalists. We rely on them for our lives, for our stories, and they don't get enough credit, and they should get more. And yeah, we lost out.
Journalist Matthew Akins is a Shell Fellow at the Nation Institute. He's usually based in Kabul. Matthew, thanks very much, and our condolences to you and the whole community of journalists in Afghanistan.
Thank you.
Our next story is also from Afghanistan and explains in part how the violence continues there. It's about the country's natural resources and how they get exploited by militant groups like the Taliban, particularly one semi-precious stone that's found pretty widely there, lapis lazuli, or lapis for short. The anti-corruption group Global Witness says the mining and selling of the stones is fueling the war in Afghanistan to the tune of $30 million in the past 2 years. My BBC colleague Justin Rowlett looked into this. His report starts inside a shop in Kabul that sells high-quality lapis.
Salam alaikum. Do you have some lapis that you could show me?
Yes, sir.
I can see why this has been treasured for thousands of years. It's incredibly beautiful, isn't it? And most of the world's supply of lapis lazuli is right here in Afghanistan, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it should be an amazing resource for the country, but in fact, the trade in lapis is fueling conflict here. By law, all mineral resources belong to the Afghan state, and the story of how this treasure is being stolen from the Afghan people is powerful evidence of how corruption is undermining Afghanistan. In a ministry building in Kabul, I met a senior official. He was too afraid to be named, but told me a warlord named Abdul Malik has seized control of the remote valley where lapis has been mined for more than 6,000 years.
The mine is under his control. There are his people.
And what about the Taliban?
They have their share too. Otherwise, there will be fighting going on between them.
An investigation by the anti-corruption NGO Global Witness has found the strongman keeps control by paying off politicians, officials and insurgent groups, including the Taliban. Stephen Carter headed up the group's two-year-long investigation.
Our information is that actually at the moment more than 50% of the revenue that's coming from the mines is being handed straight on to the Taliban. And the Taliban in Balochistan actually have quite close links to ISIS as well. So this is really a security issue.
Smugglers use mules to bring lapis out of the mine. They say Commander Malik has even improved the road over the mountains to make it easier to get his illegal bounty out of the country. Abdul Rauf Enami is an MP for the province.
Instead of creating employment and stability, the lapis mines are causing insecurity and funding the insurgency. It's a curse. It takes people's lives.
In a workshop in a basement in Kabul, craftsmen shape the brilliant blue stone into beautiful ornaments and jewellery. So if you were wondering why corruption here in Afghanistan should matter to you, here is the answer. What should be a wonderful resource for the country has ended up funding a conflict that affects us all.
The BBC's Justin Rowlett reporting from Kabul, Afghanistan. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Ever wondered how trumpeter Herb Albert created his signature sound? Tijuana Bullfights.
This brass band, you know, they used to play ba-da, ba-da-da-da-da-da-da-da before each event. I wanted to try to see if I could capture it in a record, in a sound.
Herb Albert and the Lonely Bull, ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. America is the largest weapons producer on Earth, and one of our best customers is Saudi Arabia. For the past 14 months, the Saudi kingdom has been bombing its neighbor, Yemen, using fighter jets, helicopters, bombs, and missiles, purchased for the most part from the United States. John Hudson is a senior reporter with Foreign Policy, and he follows arms sales to the Saudis. Last week, John, you reported on one U.S. weapon that the Saudis will not be getting any more of. Tell us what it is.
Yeah, so these are CBU-105 cluster bombs. They're controversial because they send a number of bomblets in a diffuse manner, and they have the capability of killing indiscriminately. They're specifically designed for anti-tank purposes. So there's a number of human rights groups have called on the U.S. not to send those types of munitions anywhere, including Saudi Arabia, where they've been waging this war on Yemen. And the White House recently made a move to block those types of cluster bomb transfers.
So how did you find out that a cluster bomb shipment was actually being held back from the Saudis?
Well, this all started with the congressional tip that I got from a source of mine. And I was later able to confirm that with the Obama administration through talking to different government officials. Now, this was not something that the Obama administration wanted to roll out or even make public. But after I was able to confirm that the block existed, they did give me an explanation when asked about it. They cited reports that cluster bombs were being used in civilian areas, which is prohibited by U.S. law.
So how many bombs are we talking about in this shipment?
So that's a really good question, and that's something that I have not been able to confirm, and human rights organizations who have followed up on this issue have not been able to confirm either. Essentially, there was a 2013 sale of American-made CBU-105 cluster bombs to Saudi Arabia. It is believed that the final shipment of those cluster bombs was not made yet, but the dollar value and the number of bombs remains something that is not known. I've also put in a call with Textron Systems, which is the manufacturer of the cluster bombs, and they said that they do not comment on the scheduling of shipments with their customers.
So the CBU-105 is a smart bomb, a really smart bomb. It detonates, and a lot of little bombs kind of go out and virtually seek out targets. If they don't find a target, it doesn't detonate. Has the CBU-105 killed anybody in Yemen?
So Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International have both done separate investigations. Human Rights Watch documented evidence of 5 different attacks using CBU-105. In the cases described, one of them involves a woman and 2 children who are in their home. Now, this has concerned a number of human rights activists and humanitarian organizations because it's expressly prohibited to use cluster bombs in civilian environments. They're supposed to be used only on military targets.
So why do you think the Obama administration singled out the CBU-105 of all the weapons that the Saudis are using?
Well, it's a good question because, you know, without cluster bombs, the Saudi coalition is still going to be able to execute this war perfectly fine. They have a large arsenal. They have a number of weapons at their disposal. This was really probably the most glaring and maybe perhaps the most embarrassing use of weapons. One, cluster bombs are very controversial. They're banned by much of the industrialized world in an international treaty in 2008. The countries that have not signed onto this treaty include the United States and Russia, which are major arms manufacturers. Mm. And the human rights organizations, Human Rights Watch in particular, was able to document and take photographs of these bomblets used. So it was very clear that American-made cluster bombs were being used in Yemen. And my guess, and it's a pretty well-informed guess because administration officials specifically cited these reports, is that it became too much of a diplomatic and political embarrassment for the administration to support and sustain.
I mean, John, you say in your article that this is the first concrete step the United States has taken to demonstrate its unease with the Saudi bombing campaign in Yemen. Do you think there are going to be more weapons that the White House is going to take a look at?
That's the most important question, and that's what everyone's asking themselves right now. The U.S. currently supplies aerial refueling support. It gives intelligence and targeting information. And as recently as November, it approved a sale of $1.3 billion in bombs to Saudi Arabia. Right now, there is no indication that any of that support is going to be held back. And in none of the statements since, when I asked about this blocking of cluster bombs, have they noted that anything else would be on the table to be brought back. That said, there has been a larger pattern of Obama administration officials expressing statements of concern about this now year-long war effort.
John Hudson is a senior reporter with Foreign Policy, speaking with us from Washington. Thank you very much, John.
Thanks so much for having me.
What more can we say about Muhammad Ali? Actually, quite a lot. You've probably already read some great Muhammad Ali stories this past weekend. We've got one from the Iranian capital, Tehran. It turns out the greatest was a popular figure in Iran, not just for his boxing skills. Ali undertook a few bouts of person-to-person diplomacy with the Islamic Republic. The world's one-man history desk, Chris Wolf, has been digging in. Chris, start by telling us what Iranians are saying about Muhammad Ali today.
Well, it turns out he was seriously popular in Tehran. Just this weekend, a member of Tehran's city council, one of the hardliners, in fact, proposed in all seriousness changing a street name to honor Muhammad Ali, which is kind of fascinating itself. Ali was a Sunni Muslim, not a Shiite, which is the predominant faith in Iran. And then Iran's foreign minister, Javad Zarif, tweeted, "May the Almighty receive Muhammad Ali, the greatest in the ring and in the fight for justice, dignity and peace."
Yeah, so why was Ali so popular in Iran? Did they overlook the Sunni thing?
Yeah, he had plenty of dealings with Iran, but the incident they're talking about the most was, in fact, a visit he made to Iran in 1993, his only visit to Iran. But anyway, while he was there, he told the Iranian news agency, "I've been to many countries, and Iran is the greatest." Now, Iranians love to hear that kind of thing. They belong to a civilization that's, as you know, at least 5,000 years old, and they generally feel that they've been pretty much disrespected in the 20th, 21st centuries by the West. So Ali saying to his Iranians, you know, "Most Americans don't know how warm and welcoming the Iranian people can be," this gets him enormous props on the streets and in the official circles as well. And they also obviously respect, you see a lot of comments today, respecting, you know, civil disobedience in the 60s, his what they call resistance to oppression and racism, his opposition to warmongering. Obviously, he famously voiced his opposition to Vietnam before it became popular,
right,
and, you know, was reviled for it.
So tell me about that visit in 1993. Why was he there in Iran?
Well, he traveled a lot to promote Islam. People might not realize this. Deeply committed to his faith, despite the toll that Parkinson's was already taking on him, which was already evident in 1993, which is the time he went to Tehran. But he went there actually as an independent goodwill ambassador to try and negotiate an exchange of prisoners of war left over from the Iran-Iraq war. And it's not actually as unusual as it sounds, because Muhammad Ali also played a key role in getting the last 15 U.S. hostages out of Iraq in 1990, just on the eve of the first Gulf War. They had been taken by Saddam Hussein after his invasion of Kuwait, and the State Department wasn't too happy about that. They called his visit to Baghdad loose cannon diplomacy.
So as far as Iran, Chris, how far back does Muhammad Ali's connection go with the country?
Well, apparently the Shah's family themselves were big fans, but then in 1979 comes the hostage crisis, and he staged a bunch of interventions. He offered himself in exchange for all 52 U.S. prisoners taken at when the embassy was stormed. That was rejected, but he also wrote letters asking for mercy. And then he actually even offered to hold his next fight in Tehran. It was supposed to be with Larry Holmes.
Wow.
And then in 1985, he went to Lebanon to try and meet with Iran's proxies in Lebanon, Hezbollah, to try and release four U.S. hostages.
And the Iran connection continued until his death?
Yeah, I mean, just in 2011, he was writing to Tehran in favor of two hikers who are still being held,
right,
Joshua Fatal and Shane Bauer. And then most recently, he was intervened on behalf of Washington Post journalist Jason Rezaian, who was held for almost 2 years.
So did Muhammad Ali's intervention in any of these episodes, did it make a difference?
Well, it's hard to say. It's not clear if his interventions ever actually led directly to somebody being released, except for obviously the case of the guys who are being held in Baghdad. But did it make a difference? Well, here are the words of Jason Rezaian, the Washington Post captive who was released from Iran. And in an exclusive interview with CNN's Jim Sciutto over the weekend, this is what he had to say about the moment that he learned that, while he was in jail still, that Muhammad Ali had spoken out on his behalf.
"I can't tell you, I can't express in words how much it meant to me, continues to mean to me. There were so many calls for my release, so much support, but getting the support of the champ touched me in ways that just still ripple through my life."
And Rezaian actually went on to say that his guards heard about it in the Iranian news, and his treatment improved remarkably for the better.
Wow, Muhammad Ali in Iran. The World's One Man History Desk, Chris Wolf, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Marco.
For nearly 5 million students in the United States, English is not their first language. So in Austin, Texas, some of these students are sent to a special school for international students where they learn English. But dozens of other languages are spoken at that school, too. So the students often learn more than just English, as Kate McGee of station KUT found out.
Muath Faria is at a desk by himself, studying for his world history final. He's writing in English, but that's not his first language, so sometimes his teacher helps him.
Miss, what means this word is still in the text?
The coordinates are how the location of a place on Earth. So
Muath is from Saudi Arabia and just got to the U.S. months ago. He wants to learn English fast and go to college. All of his classmates are learning English too, but Muath is one of the few who speaks Arabic.
Do most of the kids in this class speak Spanish?
Yeah, the most people speak Spanish. And they speak Rwanda and the other ones to Rwanda.
Spanish dominates, he says, although he knows a few students here from Rwanda. Students come to this school when they fail the state English test as a freshman or sophomore. After 2 years here, they're sent back to their neighborhood high school. The students are from all around the world, Burma, Iraq, Nepal, Rwanda, but the vast majority are from Central America, Honduras, Guatemala. That means you'll still hear Spanish in the hallways and in the classrooms when students don't understand something in English. And because so many students and teachers at this school speak Spanish, other students, including Muath, pick it up too.
Hola, ¿cómo estás? Like, bien, buenos días, it's good morning.
Muath says sometimes speaking Spanish is the only way he can socialize with students whose English is still rusty. And he says Arabic and Spanish can be pretty similar.
With Arabic, I have some words in Spanish. With Arabic, it's same. Like the sugar, in Arabic, sugar, and Spanish too, soccer.
I'll see kids from different countries actually hanging out together. They're learning about each other, just like any other teenager would.
That's Rosie Arendando, a counselor at the International High School. It's harder because of language barriers, but she also sees students trying to teach each other their native language.
I've had a Vietnamese student think that a Salvadorian girl is very beautiful and want to talk to her, so he goes and tries to speak to her in Spanish to see if she'll give him her name.
But when you're trying to learn English, hearing Spanish at the same time can make it harder. Most of the students in Muath's English class speak Spanish. The teacher, Brenda Townsend, flips back and forth between the two languages.
Okay, so what we're going to do today, this is our final nota por la clase, the final grade for this class, okay?
Muath says sometimes he gets tired of this Spanglish, especially when he wants to learn English first.
That's confused. I can't focus. If she speaks Spanish, and after that I need focus for the English.
It's a problem Townsend and other teachers at the school recognize.
No Spanish! No Spanish!
Angela Hines is another English teacher here. She hears from her non-Spanish-speaking students about these extra language hurdles they face.
And when they come to me and tell me I'm tired of hearing all the Spanish, I say, right. And I tell my students in my class, please be respectful. We have other students in the class. Please don't speak Spanish in the class. And I tell them it advances their English.
Hines says because there are so many Spanish-speaking students, they've got this huge comfort zone, and it can take them longer to learn English than the other students. But Hines says it's not a bad thing that most students speak Spanish. She tells the other students it's an opportunity.
It's an invitation for you, too, to get curious about them, not just to close the door and say, this is what they're doing to me, but how can I embrace them? Because when you embrace another culture, it opens up a space for you to be included. You know, yeah, we have a lot of Spanish here, but I think that there's a lot of learning that can take place with that.
Muath is taking advantage of that opportunity. Next year, he plans to take Spanish after school for extra high school credit. For The World, I'm Kate McGee, Austin, Texas.
We love talking about language here at The World, and you've probably heard me talking about our language podcast, The World in Words. Well, our World in Words team is hosting a live podcast in New York City about endangered languages. June 21st is the date. We promise you a night of cheesy but smart language jokes and live music, plus a few words in an endangered tongue as well. There's more information, including a place to get your free tickets, up at pri.org/language. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. There are only a few artists I can think of who, after hearing them produce one or two notes, you know it's them. Coltrane's tenor sax, Santana's guitar, Miriam Makeba's voice, and then there's that guy with a horn that's kind of jazzy, kind of loungy, kind of south of the border. Yep, Herb Albert and the Tijuana Brass. Albert was a good Jewish kid from Boyle Heights, Los Angeles, who became the poster boy for global sounds in the 1960s and would later become the A of the eclectic A&M Records label. His heyday may have been decades ago, but Herb Albert's brass is still very much alive. Right now, in fact, he's taking a stand during a rare 2-week residency at Cafe Carlyle in New York. Herb Albert joins me from New York City. It's a pleasure to meet you. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I was just reading this amazing article in Billboard magazine about the model on the cover of your great album Whipped Cream, a woman named Dolores Erickson. And she was recalling frequent trips that you and others in your posse used to take to Tijuana. And that was like the introduction to this sound. Tell us about that. What were you doing down in Tijuana? And what years were these?
I didn't have a posse to begin with. It was just me and my partner, Jerry Moss. We used to go down and watch bullfights. And I kind of got, kind of charged up with the whole feeling of the – there was a brass band in the stands. See, I never heard mariachi music, but this brass band, you know, they used to play ba-da, ba-da-da-da-da-da-da-da before each event. And they have variations on that theme as well. And so I just, after a couple of years of, you know, watching these bullfights, I wanted to try to see if I could capture it in a record, in a sound. So that's when the Lonely Bull came about.
So Jerry Moss, he's the M as in A&M Records. It was a small independent label, and this kind of flirtation with the music from south of the border really wasn't a flirtation. It kind of cemented the sound, didn't it?
Not really.
No?
I think the sound had to do with, the way I play trumpet and the songs that I chose to record. I don't. It's not a Latin group. It's just I've used some Latin instruments, but it's basically, hopefully, I think, an original sound.
I mean, the sound is unmistakable. I was listening to a track on an album that came out, I think, in the 80s, Bullish, a few days ago. And when you get to the chorus, that trumpet, that horn section just shimmers. It kind of gets into mariachi land, but then kind of pulls back.
Well, there ain't no horn section, man. It was me playing multi-trumpets. You know, it started
really, just you?
Prior to, yeah, everything. You know, I was listening to Les Paul and Mary Ford. They had a record called How High the Moon. What Les did, he layered his guitar many times over. I tried doing that at my little studio in my garage. I had two tape machines, and I'd go from one machine to the other, layering the trumpet, and I came up with this sound that was the genesis of the Tijuana Brass sound, because I played all the trumpets on all the Tijuana Brass records.
Incredible. And just layering them like that. I mean, Whipped Cream and your whole sound in those years, it was massively popular in the United States, but I was just speaking with one of our editors here in the newsroom, and his parents are, you know, middle-class Mexican family, and they listen to Whipped Cream, and I know it's, you probably would say it's not mariachi, it's not exactly authentic, but it was adored all over North and South America and the world.
Well, I was very lucky that it was, but, I try to make original music. I'm not trying to make anyone else's music, so this is what came out, and this is how I've been, it's been a very nice run for me.
Herb Albert, you also produced Sergio Mendes in Brazil 66, and interestingly, Sergio in 2014 said the song Mais Que Nada was the first time that a song in Portuguese was a hit in America and all over the world. Let's just hear a taste of Mais Que Nada, and then we'll talk a bit more. Herb Albert, so you and your record label mate Jerry Moss signed Sergio Mendes to A&M. When you started the label, were you thinking with the whole Tijuana thing that you would kind of introduce America to what we now call world music artists?
Oh, not really. We were just trying to make good records. We were not trying to reproduce the beat of the week. We were trying to get the artists that had something uniquely special to say. It was, I don't know, we've just had a really nice run trying to make records that we would buy ourselves.
Mm. There is cross-pollination taking place all over the globe today, and we feature a lot of that music right on the world. When you look across the planet today, what do you think about the music scene, the global music scene?
Oh, I think it's tremendous. I think the idea of being able to borrow from each little culture and kind of blend it all together into something, it's very special. It's very unique, and it's the YouTube of the world has, you know, kind of like brought it all together, where you can hear what's happening in remote spots and borrow a little bit from here and a little bit from there. You know, Stravinsky, the great classical composer, said, we don't borrow music from other composers. We steal.
That's honest. Do you feel like you've stolen stuff from Mexico, from Brazil, or is it borrowing with respect?
I don't think I've stolen. I think I've tried to reflect and try to put my own personality on the music I love.
Herb Albert's new album is called Come Fly With Me. It was really great meeting you. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, man, my pleasure.
That is the Herb Albert sound. You can also watch him play. We have video of Herb Albert circa 1967 performing with the Tijuana Brass. And that's at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.